On September 13, 2001, Dan Grossi got a call from the Tampa Police Department to work a private security job. He was a retired Tampa officer, so working security jobs like this wasn't that out of the ordinary, though this assignment was a little unusual. They asked Grossi if he would escort some Saudis on a flight from Tampa to Lexington, Kentucky. Remember, the skies were closed in the U.S. after 9/11, so Grossi was sure that this flight wasn't going to happen. Well, Grossi was wrong. Here's how today's project goes. In the days after 9/11, while flights in the U.S. were still grounded, the U.S. government allowed members of the Saudi royal family and the Bin Laden family to fly out of the U.S. Why might our government do this? To answer that, we're going to look at those in power in the U.S. on 9/11, namely the Bush family, and what connections they may have with the Saudis, namely the Bin Laden family, which is said to be an extension of the Saudi royal family. Then we'll look at whether the alleged Saudi flights occurred, and if so, what role political influence may have played. And we'll go down plenty of rabbit holes along the way. I'll give you a little warning when we do that, by the way. And I'll show you how this connection board got so decorated. Looks like a conspiracy Christmas tree back there. Let's make conspiracies great again. My name is Face, and welcome to Project Conspiracy. So let's get started with those in power, and a little bit of background on the Bin Laden family is going to do us some good here. If you're not interested in the Bush-Bin Laden connections, feel free to check out the timestamps and fast forward to the evidence. Osama Bin Laden's dad, Mohammed, is basically the family patriarch. He started a construction business in 1930, kept getting the lowest bids on all the contracts for the Saudi royal family, ended up developing a relationship with the royal family, and got filthy rich as a result. Like, really rich. Mohammed died in a plane crash in 1967, but the Bin Laden family stayed close to the royal family after his death. In the 1960s and 70s, the Bin Ladens were expanding their influence and making friends in the United States. Enter the Bush family, which was rising to power during this time period. So, what connections did these two powerful families have? Well, let's talk about it. The top five Bush-Bin Laden family connections. Trust me, it's a non-exhaustive list. Number five, Jim Bath, matchmaker or CIA operative? Jim Bath was an Air Force pilot turned Texas businessman. But before that, he was a member of the Texas Air National Guard. Guess who was serving there with him at the same time? George W. Bush. And to make our lives easier, I'm just going to call him George W. And for George Herbert Walker Bush, we'll just call him Bush Sr. Anyways, Bath and George W. met when they were reserve pilots in the 1970s. What else was going on in the 1970s? The Vietnam War. Yes, this is basically how George W. got out of serving in Vietnam. And he made a friend. Jim Bath also had connections with the Saudi elite, including Osama bin Laden's brother, Salim bin Laden. Salim was the eldest bin Laden brother and took over the family empire in 1967 after that plane crash. Salim bin Laden also later died in a plane crash. Weird, right? But you could almost think of Jim Bath as a type of representative to the West for the bin Ladens. He would help them with business deals and that type of thing. But some say that Jim Bath was actually a CIA agent. One guy who seemed convinced of this is Bill White. Who is Bill White? Bill White graduated from Annapolis and Harvard Business School, and he was a former Navy fighter pilot. Yes, everyone's a pilot in this story. Well, Jim Bath and Bill White actually knew each other. And Bill White described how they met on a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation show called The Fifth Estate.
This fellow, James R. Bath, needed someone to run a series of real estate companies that would be grubstaked by not only the political families, but also by some foreign nationals, the Saudis. And so I came down on an interview and met Jim.
Jim Bath ran a company called Jim Bath & Associates. But according to White, Bath seemed more interested in the Saudis.
He also ran a company in the same building called Bin Laden and Associates, which Jim explained was a procurement company for the Saudis. He bought a bank for them. He bought an airport for them. He started an airline for them, among other ventures in Houston, Texas.
And White says that's because Bath was a CIA agent. Here's how White's story goes. White says that when Bush Sr. became CIA director in 1976, the CIA wanted to reorganize a bit because some of their questionable activity had been coming out in the media around that time. As part of this, Bush Sr. needed a pilot to form an aviation venture and deal with the Saudis. Well, George W. was a former pilot, so Bush Sr. asked him if he knew anyone. George W. recommended his old buddy Jim Bath, and Bath accepted, allegedly. So, was Jim Bath a secret CIA agent, conducting covert business operations between the Bushes and Bin Ladens? Can't prove that, but his former business partner Bill White sure seemed convinced, and is strong enough to put it up on the court board. At the very least, we know that Jim Bath was a high-profile friend of both the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. So it's not surprising that Bath also plays a part in our next connection on the list. Number 4, George W.'s oil company, Arbusto Energy. You know how Foster's is Australian for beer? Well, Arbusto is Spanish for bush. Arbusto Energy was a Texas oil and gas exploration company that George W. started in 1977. Some say that Salim bin Laden either invested heavily in or even founded Arbusto with George W., but I haven't been able to find much evidence of that. Jim Bath, on the other hand, did put money into Arbusto. In June 2001, Time Magazine reported that Jim Bath put $50,000 into Arbusto early on. Time Magazine isn't the only one who claimed this. Remember how I told you I'd give you a warning for the rabbit holes?
Rabbit hole warning.
J.H. Hatfield also made claims like this in his book Fortunate Son that was published in 1999, right before the 2000 election that George W. won. Hatfield's book got a lot of attention, and it quickly climbed to the New York Times bestseller list. But Fortunate Son was also extremely controversial due to the claims made in the book. For what it's worth, Hatfield claimed the book had been screened by lawyers. But after it released, the media basically ran a smear campaign against Hatfield. They said that he was a felon who had been convicted of trying to hire a hitman to kill his former boss, and that he had pleaded guilty to embezzlement. Now, Fortunate Son was published by St. Martin's Press, which is owned by Macmillan Publishers, one of the biggest English language publishers in the world. You'd think they'd do a little background check before putting such a controversial book on the shelves, right? Well, the media pressure got to him. St. Martin's Press pulled Fortunate Son from the shelves in October of 1999. A modern-day book burning, if you will. And it didn't go much better for Hatfield after that. On July 17, 2001, a Bentonville, Arkansas police officer said that they went to Hatfield's house to arrest him on credit card fraud. The police couldn't find him, but they did find Hatfield the next day on July 18, 2001. He was dead in a motel from an apparent prescription drug overdose. At least that's what they say. Hatfield was 43 years old. According to police, Hatfield left a note citing financial problems, and the book Fortunate Son is why he did it. Seems like it would be consistent with the credit card fraud charges, right? Well, his death was less than a month after that Times article that talked about Bath putting money into Arbusto. His death was also less than 2 months before 9/11. It's always just a little suspicious when people who claim to have information get met with sudden endings. Insert Clinton joke here. Okay, back to Arbusto. We've established that Jim Bath put money into Arbusto, but some people claim that it wasn't actually Bath's money. And by some people, I'm of course talking about Bill White. White said that Bath's investment into Arbusto actually came from the Saudis, and it wasn't just $50,000, but over $1 million. George W. and Bath have both denied this. Also, author Craig Unger wrote about the relationship between the Bin Ladens and Bushes in his book called House of Bush, House of Saud. He also said that there's no evidence to support this claim. I consumed the book, by the way. That's a fancy way of saying I listened to the audiobook. But if you're interested in international politics or want to hear more about Saudi-U.S. connections, I recommend it. We'll talk more about Craig Unger's claims in just a few minutes, but he's the one that wrote about Grossi. The takeaway here is that Jim Bath, who is a mutual friend of both the Bush family and the Bin Laden family, put money into Arbusto Energy. Whether it was his money or Saudi money, we aren't sure. Number 3. Osama's CIA connections and creating a monster. So, is this one directly related to the Bushes? Meh. But we had to talk about Osama being a CIA operative, right? A little disclaimer. Sources say that no evidence of contact between the CIA and Osama bin Laden exists in the CIA archives. But it's possible that the CIA may not document those types of things. And the CIA has been known to tell a little white lie or two, or perform clandestine experiments on unwilling humans. But there may be some connections between the CIA and Osama bin Laden. Here's how it goes. In 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, which started the Soviet-Afghan War. Osama went to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviets. The Cold War was going on at this time, and the United States didn't want the Soviet Union to expand their influence. The U.S. also didn't want to get into a direct conflict with a nuclear power that we've been playing chicken with for years. We prefer proxy wars, or at least we used to before George W. So from 1979 to 1992, the United States, through the CIA, along with other countries like Saudi Arabia and China, gave somewhere between $6 to $12 billion in financial aid and weapons to help the fighters that Osama was with. Now, they didn't give it directly to Osama bin Laden, or even directly to the fighters. Rather, they ran the guns and money through Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Agency, or the ISI. That's their three-letter agency like the CIA. During that time, bin Laden was running an organization known as the MAC, which funneled money and arms in from other countries. The MAC was supported by Pakistan's ISI, which is how the CIA was getting money and guns in to help the fighters against the Soviets. Basically, the CIA gave guns and money to the Pakistan ISI. The ISI gave it to the MAC, in which bin Laden played a critical role. Through their efforts, the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989. For Osama, after the war, he became seen as a hero of jihad, or a war hero by the Saudis, at least for a little while. But this also put Osama's life on a track in which he felt he needed to focus his violent efforts against the United States, which ultimately led to 9/11. So, this isn't directly related to a Bush. I couldn't find a picture of Bush handing Osama bin Laden money. But consider Bush's role as president and vice president during this time period. And also, he used to be the CIA director. Bush Sr. was also very involved in politics in this part of the world, so it's hard to imagine he wouldn't have had his hand in this, or at least been aware of it. But Bush Sr.'s connections with the bin Ladens are a little more transparent in our next connection. Number 2. Bush Sr. and the bin Ladens joined the Carlyle Group. So after Ross Perot mucked up the 1992 election for Bush Sr., the next year he became involved with the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group was founded in 1987 and named after the Carlyle Hotel in New York City. In a nutshell, Carlyle was a company that flipped other companies. Carlyle would buy private companies that weren't doing so great, overhaul them, and turn around and sell them for millions or billions of dollars. For instance, Carlyle bought Magnavox Electronic Systems in 1993 for $165 million. 2 years later, they turned around and sold it for $370 million. They've got a global presence and are huge. Bush Sr. was a member of the Asia Advisory Board. He would help get investors in that type of thing. For example, in 2000, Bush Sr. reportedly went to a luxurious desert compound outside of the Saudi capital and met with Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia to discuss American-Saudi business dealings. The Bush connections with the Saudis go much deeper than just the bin Ladens, if you can't tell. The bond of oil can't be broken. Oil is thicker than water? Whatever, I went for it. And of course, the bin Ladens are there to support their buddy Bush Sr. on his new business venture. After Bush Sr. got involved, around 1994, the bin Ladens put up $2 million in a fund called the Carlyle Partners II, which was a very large defense-oriented fund. Normal people send a friend a housewarming gift when they get a new home. The bin Ladens send Bush Sr. a couple mil to say congrats on the new business gig. Shockingly, after 9/11 happened, Carlyle, or maybe just the New York Times, tried to downplay the investment, describing it as a tiny fraction of the $1.3 billion raised for the fund. Fair enough. That said, some say the bin Laden contribution to Carlyle was much bigger than that, with the $2 million being just the initial contribution, and those contributions would escalate over time. You can imagine that Carlyle's not turning over those business records. And in October 2001, right after 9/11, the bin Ladens decided to liquidate their stake in Carlyle. The separation was described as being by mutual agreement. But, as you can imagine, there was controversy about the bin Laden's stake in a company that invested heavily in military and aerospace buyouts, especially when we were on a track for war sparked by their relative Osama bin Laden. Not a good look, and neither is our last connection on the list. Number 1. Bush Sr. and Osama bin Laden's brother had breakfast on the morning of 9/11. Here's how this one goes. On September 11, 2001, members of the Carlyle Group, including Bush Sr. and his former Secretary of State, James Baker, were meeting at the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. with Shafiq bin Laden, who was Osama bin Laden's brother, a.k.a. Bush Sr. and Osama bin Laden's brother had breakfast on 9/11. A lot of people hear this claim and think, that's just an urban legend. There's no way that's true. Well, so Carlyle's 2001 investor conference was a two-day event that took place on September 10th and September 11th, 2001 at the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. Shafiq bin Laden, Osama's brother, was the guest of honor. From what I could dig up, it seems like at least James Baker and Frank Carlucci were there with Shafiq bin Laden on September 11th. And I did find sources that said that Bush Sr. was also there on the morning of September 11th. I also found sources that say that Bush Sr. was actually there with Shafiq bin Laden on September 10th, the day before the attacks. Based on what I've seen, this seems more likely to be the case. But this claim is pretty close to being true. And any way you slice it, probably not a good look for Bush Sr. to be having breakfast with Osama's relative that close to 9/11. And Bush Sr. has a history of not having a good look.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
And you might have heard about the alleged connections between the Bush family and John Hinckley's family. John Hinckley was the guy who tried to murder President Reagan in 1981 to impress Jodie Foster. The truth really is stranger than fiction. Anyways, those are the connections between the Bushes and the bin Ladens, not an exclusive list. But based on these connections, one could argue that the post 9/11 George W. White House at least had some incentive to try to help the Saudis and the bin Ladens out after the attacks. And it would have taken that kind of influence to fly after 9/11 during the airspace lockdown. But did that actually happen? Let's take a look at the evidence right after this. You thought you were getting an ad, didn't you? Well, it's our first episode, so guest again. Let's get to today's main event, the alleged clandestine Saudi flights. Some of you may have heard of this conspiracy from Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11, but the inspiration for today's episode actually comes from an unlikely place. Snopes. Yes, that's Snopes. Look, I could have opened this whole episode by talking about Fahrenheit 9/11, but I don't really want to talk about Michael Moore. But if you were hoping for some fun at Michael Moore's expense, I get it. But go check out Team America World Police. It holds up better than you think, and it's pretty funny. Do that after you finish this video, of course. And make sure to hit the subscribe button here if you're having fun. So what does Snopes say about the alleged Saudi flights? Well, their article on the issue is actually quite the journey. Paragraph after paragraph of detail. The sheer amount of words that they have to use to debunk this one made me want to look into it more. And here's how Snopes frames the claim. Secret flights whisked bin Laden family members and Saudi nationals out of the U.S. immediately after September 11th while a general ban on air travel was still in effect, and before the FBI had any opportunity to question any of the passengers. Well, the word whisked seems a little hyperbolic, maybe trying to make people sound a little crazy, but overall, generally fair characterization of the issue, Snopes. Next, Snopes immediately rules it false. We saw that one coming. By the way, did you see what they named the URL? Flights of Fancy. I hate them. To prove this claim false, it looks like Snopes cites almost exclusively to the 9/11 Commission final report. So the 9/11 Commission was created by Congress and signed off on by George W. to create a full and complete account of the circumstances surrounding the September 11th attacks. In its final report, the 9/11 Commission purports to answer three main questions about these flights. Let's take them in order. First question. Did any flights of Saudi nationals take place before national airspace reopened on September 13, 2001? Obviously, the commission answered this one no, or we probably wouldn't be here talking about it today. The second question that the 9/11 Commission addressed. Was there any political intervention to facilitate the departure of Saudi nationals? Snopes and the commission say it never got to anyone in the White House higher than Richard Clark. Who was Richard Clark? On 9/11, Clark was the counterterrorism czar. That's really what pretty much everyone calls it. But his official title was National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure, Protection, and Counterterrorism for the United States. Counterterrorism czar just kind of rolls off the tongue better. Before that, he had also worked in the State Department under Reagan and in high-level national security positions under Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton, aka Slick Willie, who actually appointed him as the counterterrorism czar. He kept the position under George W. So Richard Clark testified before the commission on March 24, 2004. Here's what Clark first told the 9/11 Commission about these flights.
In the days following 9/11, whether it was on 9/12 or 9/15, I can't tell you, someone brought to that group a proposal that we authorize a request from the Saudi embassy. They feared for the lives of Saudi citizens because they thought there would be retribution. The Saudi embassy therefore asked for these people to be evacuated. The request came to me, and I refused to approve it. I suggested that it be routed to the FBI and that they approve it or not.
Why did they come to Clark with this request?
The reason that a decision was needed was because the flight embargo, the grounding, was still in effect.
When asked who initially approached him with this issue, Clark claimed he couldn't remember, but he was able to narrow it down to a couple of likely sources.
The two possibilities that are most likely are either the Department of State or the White House Chief of Staff's office.
Sound like political intervention to you? The third question addressed by the 9/11 Commission was, did the FBI screen Saudi nationals thoroughly before their departure? Here's what the 9/11 Commission said on that issue. We believe that the FBI conducted a satisfactory screening of Saudi nationals who left the United States on charter flights. That word believe, such a very particular and intentional word, isn't it? Notice that they didn't say that the evidence showed that the FBI had conducted satisfactory screenings. One reason may be because of the Richard Clark testimony.
I don't think they were ever interviewed in this country.
More on the FBI in a moment, I promise. But now it's time to come back to Dan Grossi, the former Tampa police officer who says he was on the flight from Tampa with the Saudis. And this is where Craig Unger comes in. He documented Grossi's story in a 2003 Vanity Fair article and in his book, House of Bush, House of Saud. Unger wrote that after the attacks, Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi ambassador to the United States, was organizing a way for more than 140 Saudi nationals to leave the country. Among these Saudis that Bandar was trying to get out were members of the Saudi royal family and the bin Laden family. By the way, the Saudis wanting to leave quickly after 9/11 isn't necessarily suspicious. Saudis had just attacked the U.S., and if we look back in history at how the Japanese Americans were treated after Pearl Harbor happened, one can imagine why the Saudis might be in a rush to leave after 9/11. One of the Saudis in the U.S. was Prince Ahmad bin Salman, a member of the Saudi royal family who is in Lexington, Kentucky for the annual September yearling auctions. And Lexington is where Grossi's flight from Tampa was headed. According to Unger, Grossi got a call on September 13th from the Tampa PD, and they asked Grossi if he could help escort some Saudi students from Tampa to Lexington because the Tampa PD couldn't do it. You know, that pesky jurisdiction rule. Grossi was told to go to Tampa International and bring someone to help him. Grossi called Manuel Perez, who was a former FBI agent. Grossi said,
"Quite frankly, I knew that everything was grounded. I never thought this was going to happen."
But Grossi was wrong. Around 1:30 or 2 p.m. on September 13th, Grossi received a call saying that the Saudis would be delivered to Raytheon Airport Services, which was a private hangar at Tampa International Airport. Perez met Grossi there, and a pilot arrived and told them that they had their plane. Grossi and Perez say that three young Saudi men arrived, and the pilot took them to a Learjet that took off to Lexington around 4:30 p.m. So, who were these Saudis? Well, Dan Grossi didn't know and apparently didn't ask a lot of questions. But Grossi did say that one of the Saudis told them that his either father or uncle was good friends with Bush Sr. The Saudi also said that the flight was allowed as a favor. It was later reported that one of the Saudis in Tampa was Prince Sultan. He's a grandnephew of the late King Fahd and was going to school in Tampa. Sultan's uncle was Prince Ahmad, who was in Lexington at the horse auctions. Ahmad told Sultan to get on a plane and get to Lexington so they could leave the U.S. So Sultan did. Perez, the FBI agent with Grossi, said he didn't realize who Prince Sultan was until they landed, and a host of security arrived, and then the hand-kissing began for Prince Sultan. In Lexington, they landed at Bluegrass Airport, which is situated conveniently among horse farms and located directly across from the Keeneland Racecourse. So, according to Grossi, when they arrived in Lexington, the Saudis were met by an American who took custody of the Saudis and helped them with their baggage. On the tarmac was a 747 with Arabic writing on the fuselage, apparently ready to take them out of the country. So, did this happen? The White House denied that the Tampa flight occurred. The FAA also denied that the flight took place. Chris White, a spokesperson for the FAA, said the flight's not in their logs. The FBI denied the flight too, and the FBI got pretty specific. After Craig Unger's 2003 Vanity Fair article came out telling Dan Grossi's story, some senators started asking questions. So the FBI prepared a report addressing all Saudi travel out of the U.S. after 9/11. The FBI said that no flights arrived in Lexington on that day. They also said that Sultan and his friends had arrived from Tampa to Lexington by car. The FBI went even further and said that Sultan had disobeyed Prince Ahmad by traveling by car instead of by jet as the prince had instructed them. But journalist Gene Heller confirmed that the Tampa flight occurred in a 2004 Tampa Bay Times article on the issue. Gene Heller, by the way, was a journalist who in 1972 first broke the story of the CDC's Tuskegee syphilis study. According to Heller, Tampa International admitted that this flight occurred when the 9/11 Commission finally asked about it in 2004 after Richard Clark's interview, and the airport gave details. The plane landed at Tampa International at 3:34 p.m. and then took off at 4:37 p.m. headed north. That's exactly what Dan Grossi said. The plane then returned to Tampa around 8:23 p.m., also what Grossi said. And Heller reached out to Grossi before writing this article. He declined to talk about it in detail, but he did say this.
"I'm over it. The White House, the FAA, and the FBI all said the flight didn't happen. Those are three agencies that are way over my head, and that's why I'm done talking about it."
However, Grossi did confirm that his account in Craig Unger's book was accurate, but this next part is just weird, and Heller's the only one I've seen report on it. For better or worse, I think we're going to have to hit it again.
Rabbit hole warning.
Remember how Dan Grossi said he was supposed to meet the Saudis at Raytheon Airport Services at Tampa International? Well, according to Heller, Raytheon Aircraft was the only facility at Tampa International that serviced chartered flights like the one Grossi was on. Raytheon collected landing fees from only two aircraft on September 13th, and one of them was a Lear 35 that sounds like the one Grossi might have been on. However, that Lear had a tail number which, according to federal records, was assigned to a Cessna based in Michigan. Heller contacted the owner of the Cessna, who confirmed that he owned the plane with that tail number and that he owned it before the attacks. The owner said that someone must have gotten the registration number wrong in Tampa. Assuming what Heller writes is true, there's only two possible conclusions. One, there was no record of the flight Grossi and the Saudis were on. Or two, the record for that flight is not accurate. If I'm missing a connection here, let me know down in the comments. Or just type in literally any character and post a comment, because the engagement helps more than you think. So what does Snopes and the 9/11 Commission say about all this? Well, the Richard Clark testimony that we looked at took place on March 24, 2004. The Gene Heller article was published on June 9, 2004. And the 9/11 Commission's final report was released about a month and a half later on July 22, 2004. So when the 9/11 Commission issued its final report, they couldn't deny that this flight took place like the FAA, the White House, and the FBI did. It looks like they also didn't make much time to investigate it, and it shows in their report. By the way, guess where they talk about the Tampa flight in the final report? Well, the 9/11 Commission's final report in PDF format is 567 pages. The Tampa flight is addressed on page 556 to 557, just 10 pages before the end, and in only two paragraphs. It's getting hard to believe that this stuff isn't intentional, right? Based on when the report came out, the commission had to admit that the flight occurred, but they said that airspace was open at that time. And the 9/11 Commission was actually correct about this. On September 13, 2001, on the day of Grossi's flight, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta ordered that the National Airspace System be reopened to commercial and private aviation effective at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So when the Tampa flight took off, the skies were at least partially open. It's possible that Grossi just wasn't aware of this. That said, the reopening included paid chartered flights, but not private, non-revenue flights. So it seems like whether this flight was legal depends on whether or not it was paid for. This is the conclusion that Gene Heller appears to come to, and I would tend to agree. But without better records, it's tough to say. Although, in fairness, I doubt these Saudis would have minded paying for their flight. But the 9/11 Commission's report strays from Grossi's account of that day, and it leaves out quite a lot. For example, the commission's end note omits Grossi's account about what happened after they landed at Bluegrass in Lexington. Remember, Grossi told Unger that he thought that there was a 747 there with the Arabic writing on it, apparently ready to take them back to Saudi Arabia. Grossi later doubled down on what he told Unger in his interview with Heller, and the 9/11 commission did interview Grossi in May 2004. He told them pretty much the same thing. Not only that, but Grossi told the commission that he was disturbed by the fact that the FBI initially claimed that the Saudis drove to Lexington. But the 9/11 Commission doesn't address any of this in its report. Also, the 9/11 Commission fails to even mention the identities of anyone on the Tampa flight, and it doesn't mention anything about the issue of political intervention. Remember, Grossi didn't ask a lot of questions on the plane, but he did claim that one of the Saudis said to have a connection with Bush Sr. He told the 9/11 Commission this too. We also heard what Richard Clark said about where the request for the flights probably came from. Wouldn't these accounts be relevant to the 9/11 Commission's question about potential political intervention? So we've got some problems with the 9/11 Commission investigation. And in getting to this point, it looks like we've come across some issues that really no one's addressed yet. Based on Heller's reporting and what the FAA said, why does it look like the record of the Tampa flight may be missing or altered? Why did the White House, FAA, and the FBI originally deny that the Tampa flight took place? Finally, Unger's narrative insinuates that that 747 was there on the tarmac, ready to take the Saudis back to Saudi Arabia. If that happened any time near the time that they landed in Lexington, it sure seems unlikely that the FBI would have been able to screen them. Remember, the FBI originally denied that the flights even happened, although they did admit that later they learned that it took place. How much later? After the 747 left the country later? But if it brings you any comfort, the 9/11 Commission believes the FBI was on top of it. Here's what we can take away from all of this. We still have unanswered questions about the Tampa flight and what happened with the Saudis after they landed in Lexington. The U.S. government appears to have changed its story about the Tampa flight. And for the FBI, in the best case, they were misinformed and tardy. And in the worst case, they outright lied. So, contrary to what Snopes says, this conspiracy may not be such a flight of fancy after all. I'm posting my sources here on YouTube, by the way, for your convenience. And look, I take a lot of pride in my research, but it's entirely possible that I've missed something or messed something up. And if you think I did, let me know down in the comments. Or join our Discord and let me know there. Either way, I think that we can agree that there's something weird going on with the FBI in these flights. But if you want to hear about some mischievous CIA activities, check out this video here. We talk about aliens in the Soviet Union too, and when the CIA used a cat as a spy. I appreciate you taking the time to join me on this project, and we'll see you on the next one. Until then, watch out for the lizard people.